I really enjoyed going into a recording session, not knowing what I was going to be asked to do, not knowing anything about the music, and having it put in front of me and challenging myself to, you know, to read it right and play it right and come up with something cool right away. You know, I kind of prided myself in that, you know, because that's what I thought, what made the difference, pardon the phrase, between the men and the boys, or the, you know, ladies and the girls, to like, you know, come in and really kind of throw down right away, you know, when you got in there and do something that was not only the right thing, but could, like, when you left the session, they go, yeah, man, Tim came in and he nailed it, you know.
Welcome to episode 99 of the Bass Shed Podcast. My name is Ryan Roberts. What's up, folks? All right, I'm going to try this little bit on the front part of the show this time. If you are a first-time listener of the podcast, please hit subscribe on whatever platform you are listening to it on. You can also stop by thebassshed.com/podcast and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Leave a comment, leave a rating, maybe leave a comment about leaving a rating, maybe even rate your own comment. You know, you could type in the comment, 5 stars. We're all probably musicians here. You can get creative with it. All right. On the episode is electric bassist Tim Landers. Tim Landers is a session player, spending some time on the New York session scene and working as a session player here in Los Angeles. Tim has a ridiculous resume. He's worked with jazz fusion artists such as Al Di Meola, Billy Cobham, and Gil Evans. Tim has also worked with Tracy Chapman, Tori Amos, Lee Ritenour, and Dave Grusin. In addition to all that, if that wasn't super impressive enough, in addition to all that, Tim has made incredible contributions to bass guitar design. He was on the ground floor with the Padula Buzz Bass and the PV Dyna Bass, as well as his signature series, the PV TL5 and TL6. Obviously, TL stands for Tim Landers. It's an absolute treat to have him on the podcast. I heard Tim a few weeks ago at the Baked Potato here in Los Angeles. That night he was performing with two fantastic guitar players that were co-leading the night. The guitar players were Alan Hines and Brad Rabuchin. Brad and I had done some playing over the years, and I hadn't seen him since the world kind of opened back up. So it was great to hang with him and hear him play. On drums that night was Chris Wabich. And for regular listeners of the podcast, you might remember Wabich from episode 41 of the Bass Shed Podcast. He's also the drummer on my record, actually. Which, you know, all right, as a tangent, speaking of Wabich, right, that's the thing I do. I do two things. I speak of Wabich and I go on tangents. So, the update on my album. I just got the tracks back from the first round of recalls on the mix. I can't remember where I was when the mix engineer sent it to me, but I pulled it up on some legit monitors when I got home, obviously listening to it on just earbuds from the phone. Wasn't going to cut it. I can do better than that. I had a couple things to say and I sent it back. The mixer got me over another version the next day. I sent that to Wabich, actually, to get his ears on it too. I'm happy to report that the album is even closer to completion. Again, the album is titled Smile, after the Charlie Chaplin tune, and I'm stoked that it's nearing the finish line, and I will keep you updated on that. And more information on it all very, very soon. That will be a good day. When it's just out. All right, and now, you know, speaking more. I don't think this tangent is related to Wabich at all. But it probably should be. I feel like I should rope Wabich into this somehow. Speaking of things getting closer, the launch party for the Bass Shed Academy is getting closer. Actually, I just got all the documents back in the mail the other day from the California Secretary of State saying that I'm legit. So, you know, thanks for the validation, Secretary of State. I'll take what I can get. They also sent me this book of things you should know when starting a nonprofit. So I started reading through that. It is pretty overwhelming, like all this stuff related to starting the nonprofit, and that was my evening. Was reading through this book, you know, and how to construct the bylaws while having the football game on in the background. Yeah, I'm a football fan. That's a thing. I'm a Denver Broncos fan, actually. And while I'd like to say it was disappointing watching the Broncos lose again, for anybody that's following the NFL season this year, I wasn't shocked. And it's getting to a point where I'm not even disappointed anymore when the Broncos lose. I'm kind of just expecting it. Those fellas cannot seem to close in the red zone. You know what I mean? Like, they just can't make it happen. I don't know how many tangents deep I am at this point. But the Bayshed Academy launch party is coming up. You can check that out at thebayshed.com/academy. The folks and I, Ed Lemer, are tightening all that up. We're tightening up the launch party on January 7th and the programs and policies in general for all of it. For the lessons program there, not the launch party. There's no real policy for the launch party. But definitely make sure to stop by lemermusic.com for everything you need for the double bass. Check out their sheet music, the bass accessories, the basses, etc. Etc. Use the promo code TheBassShed, all one word, for 10% off at lemermusic.com. All right. I think the tangents have concluded. the tangent segment of the show has come to an end. I was talking about Tim Landers at the Baked Potato. I had a wonderful time listening to Tim play and listening to his decisions. You know, that's how I listen to bass players. Is obviously, I don't know, there's no percentage to really qualify, but most bass players are technically capable of more than they're playing at any time. And so, you know, really getting into why they're making this musical decision and what is it in the music that's impacting what they are playing. That's always really exciting to me. And listening to it with those ears, listening to Tim play with those ears and just checking out his decisions all night was wonderful. He was making fantastic musical decisions and really, really just laying down such a strong, strong foundation for two guitar players that had a lot to say. They were dropping a lot of stuff harmonically and rhythmically. These two guitar players were really being creative on top, and Tim was just crushing it. The mark of a true bass player and a true pro. It was really inspiring. It was great to have him on the podcast, and here it is. Here's my talk with session bass player and jazz fusion bass player, Tim Landers. Tim?
Hey, Ryan. How you doing, man?
Doing well. How you doing?
Yeah, good. Thanks.
Good. Yeah. What are you up to today?
Oh, yeah. Real exciting stuff.
Like going to the DMV or something?
Well, it's close. I mean, I brought a car in to have a mechanic look at it because I need a brake job on one of my cars. So
okay.
That was exciting. I went to the gym.
Nice.
It was exciting. And I'm going to do a bike ride after this, so no playing today.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Do you just like stay on the streets riding the bike, or do you get up into the hills and the mountains?
Yeah, so I live up close to Mulholland and Topanga.
Okay.
You know, out in the West Valley.
Yeah.
And I do a little bit of, you know, off-road stuff, so I have like a little, like mild mountain biking.
Nice.
You know, nothing really crazy.
Yeah.
And I like biking. I have a road bike, and I have like a hybrid bike I do for just chores and stuff, and then I have a gravel bike I just got, which is kind of fun.
Okay.
But I haven't really been able to find like gravel specific paths around here, but
right.
Yeah, it's fun, man.
That's cool, man.
Good way to get outside.
Yeah, right. Get some exercise, get some sunshine.
Exactly. Yeah.
Those are all good things. So you're going to go to the gym and do the ride?
I already went to the gym.
Okay, that's an active day.
Well, you know, I went to the gym to work on with some weights because I don't get any weight training on the bike. And I have, right. I was like, I just came off this tour, like just a couple of weeks ago, and I was sitting on a bus for 6 weeks.
Oh, right. Just everything's...
So my routine was like, you know,
yeah.
Like my jeans weren't fitting, you know. I'm like, okay, man, I got to get back out there, into my thing. I had a pretty cool, you know, regimen going on beforehand where I every morning, for like the last couple of years, like since the pandemic, and, you know, doing a regular exercise routine, a lot of biking. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, on the road, I couldn't do any of it.
Right.
You know, the occasional like hotel gym,
sure.
You know, but our schedule was so crazy that even if I had time in the morning to go to the gym, I'd just be so wiped out.
Yeah.
That I didn't have the energy to put a real workout in, you know?
Right. Who was the tour?
So I was out with Billy Cobham.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
You've been working with him for a while.
Yeah, off and on, you know?
Yeah.
I met Billy in January of 1980.
Okay. So,
which was kind of a funny story in itself, but and then I worked with him for a few years from that point, and then I left his band right when I moved to LA.
Okay.
I was living in New York at the time. So, and I had, while I was working with Billy, I was also doing other things, and I was starting to do record dates, you know, in New York, and then I started doing record dates out in California. So, you know, the drummer, Vinny Colaiuta, was getting me on these records, and he would, and I would do the same for him. I would get him on records I was doing in New York.
Okay.
So every time I came to LA, I'd be like, hey, man, it's cool out here. You know, I mean, I'd been out here a few times, but I was living in New York City, Midtown, you know, had a good area, but my apartment was just a typical New York apartment, you know, a small place with a bunch of bars on the windows. And, and I'd come to LA and Vinny had picked me up. And at the time, at one time, just before I moved here, he had an old Austin Healey 3000, really cool vintage car. And he picked me up at the airport with that, and we went back to his house. And he had just bought a house, you know, in the valley. He had a nice ranch house with a pool and a garage. And I was just going, looking at this, going, this is the way to go.
Yeah.
You know, and I go back to New York and I have my little dingy apartment, you know. And I'm like, yeah, you know. So on top of that, I had people encouraging me to come out here. Yeah, okay. If you come out here, man, you'll work, you know, you'll do this, you do that. And so I finally said, okay, I'm gonna take the leap, you know.
And that was 1980?
84.
Okay.
The beginning of 84. I don't actually, it started in 83, but I think officially I moved here in March of 84. You know, that's when I got my first apartment. Because I kind of lived at Vinny's house for a while.
Was it true? Did you get plugged in pretty quick? And like, did you get into the scene here pretty?
Interestingly, you know, I thought coming from New York and who I'd been playing with, because I'd been playing not only with Billy, but with, you know, LD Miola and Lenny White and the Brecker Brothers and Gil Evans Orchestra and all kinds of, I was doing all kinds of stuff and some pop dates and stuff. And I thought, well, I'll just, you know, I'll just come to LA and they're going to love me. I'm going to just this. and what I discovered was that there was a little bit more loyalty out here. The whole session scene was different than New York in the sense that in New York, if you come into town and you're like the new young gun, you know, and you're like really happening, then a producer is going to start to hire you and bands are going to start pick you up because they want the, you know, the latest, greatest, newest thing.
Sure.
In LA, there was a little bit more of like you kind of work your way up to that.
Okay. And then find your own guys that will call you regularly and cultivate your little crew.
Yeah. I mean, so like, you know, the people that were doing most of the record dates had been here, had been established, and there was a reason why they were doing it, which is another part of the story too, was like it was a different approach to working in the studio. Mm. You know, like out here in LA, people had brought their own gear, for instance, to sessions. Whereas in New York, you just brought your acts and you played with whatever they had at the studio.
Okay.
You know,
but so you were like, bringing your own amp and your whole rig?
So in LA, you know, everybody was showing up with like they had cartage services and you'd go to the date and so-and-so would, you know, be Dan Huff on guitar or Landau or somebody like that. And they'd have their, you know, their Bradshaw rack and their, I mean, Bradshaw pedals and their rack, their tall racks with all this stuff. This you know, early 80s. So everyone had all this gear. They brought
sessions. Like all this rack spaces.
You know, guitar players had all their like boutique, guitar players had their boutique amp heads and, you know, the Bogners and the Dumbles and, you know, and like, oh, they've got a Marshall kind of cabinet or they had a, you know, a Fender cabinet or whatever they had. So there's all this stuff, you know. Whereas in New York, man, a guitar player would show up to a session and plug into the twin that kind of half worked, that you know, and that's just the way it was.
Yeah.
You know, and like
just slap it on the side a couple times to get it to come together.
And the other thing that was different too is like in New York, you know, you really hoped the engineer would kind of try to get a decent sound for you because they didn't have time to screw around with anything. And out in LA, the engineers kind of really counted on you giving them a great sound right out of your system.
Right.
Like, for instance, these elaborate, you know, rack systems and multiple amp things that guys like Dean Parks and, you know, George, what's his last name? Come to me in a second. They had these guys had their sounds. They gave like a stereo feed to the engineer, and they had everything happening already.
Yeah.
You know, their crunchy sound, their little bit of reverb, you know, whatever it was, a little delay, a little chorusing, is all coming out of their own racks, right? Mm-hmm. In New York, it was like, hey man, can you give me a little chorus on this? And I go, the engineer goes, okay, maybe, yeah, maybe. You know,
which one did you prefer? Did you like relinquishing control to the engineer, or did you like being in the mix?
I liked, you know, coming out here, I liked the ability to be able to kind of, you know, mold my sound a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
Because in New York, you know, it depended on who was actually recording you and what they did with it afterward, like really had a lot to do with what you ultimately sounded like.
Sure. Do you feel like you were misrepresented on some of those New York dates?
Maybe not misrepresented, but I mean, I was sometimes disappointed, you know, with the sound that eventually came out. I mean, Marcus Miller was already doing dates, and he was young then. So he was still about 18 or 19 or so, but he had his thing down. He already had his Stars guitars preamp in his jazz bass, you know? And so he was already giving a preamplified sound to the mix, to the engineers, and everybody loved it, but we couldn't figure out exactly what he was doing just yet.
You know? Okay.
I mean, there were people like Ken Smith started his basses around that time too. And he had a prototype bass that he kind of sent around New York, and all the players got a chance to play it, you know, for a few days or a week or something. And that bass had on board, you know, I don't know if you've ever heard of the original Ken Smith bass, but it had like all this gold hardware, and underneath the plate on the bass was not just EQ and a preamp, but it also had like, I think it had it definitely had an envelope filter on it, and it and it might have had some kind of chorus or flanging on it. Yeah, so built in. So it was kind of like, it's like it had a lot of stuff on it, but everybody loved that bass, not just for that, but also the way it played. But it was a beginning of bass players having a little bit of control.
Was that a response to, because Ken Smith was a New York manufacturer?
It was a response to that. Yeah.
To the session thing.
To the session thing, because people wanted to be able to, like bass players wanted to be able to get something a little bit different than the jazz bass or a P bass sound, you know, going through a B15.
Right.
Which was kind of like the thing, you know, when all the bass players in New York that were doing all the dates then, you know, people like, you know, Will Lee and Gordon Edwards and Anthony too, to a certain degree, I'm probably forgetting half a dozen guys, but Chuck Rainey, you know, they were playing P basses mostly, you know, jazz basses and stuff, and they were just going direct into the board, and it was what it was. Of course, their playing is what made everything happen.
Right.
But, you know, when Anthony started doing stuff like he was doing with the sounds he was getting, and Marcus started doing what he was doing, getting the sounds he was getting. So Marcus with his, you know, kind of now trademark kind of scooped, you know, slap thing. And Anthony with his super clean, you know, sometimes with a pick, you know, bright kind of thing, you know, he was doing. That wasn't a, you know, a P bass going through a B15.
Right.
It was something else, you know.
Right.
So when I came to LA, you know, suddenly I had more leeway to be able to like start to mold my sound a little bit. And that's when I started getting into the sonics of what I was playing. Mm-hmm. And this kind of also led itself to when I started designing my bass signature series
for
a couple of manufacturers. Kind of came from me learning all these things as I was going through the session thing in LA and putting my own rig together. You know, I was watching other bass players, and I'd go see, you know, Nathan East, or go see Jimmy Johnson or Neil Steubenhaus, or, you know, and see what they were playing through and what they brought to dates, you know, recording sessions. And I started to kind of, you know, with the limited budget I had, try to put stuff together.
Sure. What were some of those initial items that you were when you're building out your rig?
Yeah, well, the first thing was like bass players were starting to use like a a modular system, a preamp and a power amp, and then like some kind of custom speaker configuration where it was, either it was built by somebody or it was, you know, before any of those amps were out, like the SWRs and then Epiphone or, you know, these kind of modular things with a two-way with a tweeter.
Yeah.
You know, people started building those things themselves or having them made. Okay. So you would have like a Furman or an Olympic preamp, you know, with like a Yamaha power amp and like a two-way cabinet.
Okay.
Now you could give that to the sound engineer and you could, you know, you could customize your sound a little bit with the EQ that was on your preamp. Like the Furman preamp was known for its parametric EQ. So you could get just about any kind of tone you wanted out of it.
Yeah.
That was cool.
Pretty dialed.
That was new.
Right.
You know, to be able to do that instead of just going direct out of your bass, out of your, you know, basically out of a Fender, which had volume controls and a, you know,
a master volume or two if it's a jazz bass and then a master tone. Right.
Yeah. So now you had a lot more control over your sound and you could be a little bit more creative sonically. You know, I really dug that.
Yeah.
So to answer your question 10 minutes ago, it's like coming from the New York thing and then coming to LA where there was a lot more, you know, acceptance of this kind of, you know, rig to bring to a date. Because in New York, you know, again, there was time restraints and there was also logistical restraints. New York, the studios are all in the city, you know, all up in, you know, the third, eighth floor of a building. You know, there's not... Unless you used SIR, you didn't really have cartage service. You couldn't really lug all this crap into a date. They didn't give you time to set your stuff up. And, you know, there was a scene. You just come in, man. It's like a jingle date, especially, or like a pop date. You just come in and plug in and you just start playing, you know?
Yeah. What kind of information would you get on these sessions when you just walk in and they're kind of cranking them out? Were you getting lead sheets or chord charts or... charts?
Yeah. That varied a lot, but most of the time, let's say in New York, it was definitely a lot of times they had an arranger. Let's say it was a jingle date and everything would be, you know, on paper.
Okay.
A lot of times for those things, it could be just a simple chord chart.
Okay.
You know, but sometimes it'd be a specific line written, but definitely there was reading involved.
Yeah.
You know, all the recording dates that I did, you know, whenever they were what I would call like industrial dates, if they were like television or film,
sure,
or jingles, you know, work.
Yeah.
You know, that stuff was always like, you know, in and out, you know, you're reading from the get go and the better, you had to be a good reader. But of course, doing record dates when you're working with an artist, that was a completely different thing.
There's more creative input,
yeah,
right?
That's when you're working out, you know, parts.
Sure.
You know, actually being part of the creative process.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems a lot more fulfilling.
It is. But at the same time, I really enjoyed going into a record date going into a recording session, not knowing what I was going to be asked to do, not knowing anything about the music and having it put in front of me and challenging myself to, you know, to read it right and play it right and come up with something cool right away. You know, I kind of prided myself in that. You know, because that's what I thought, what made the difference between, pardon the phrase, between the men and the boys or the, you know, ladies and the girls to like, you know, come in and really kind of throw down right away, you know, when you got in there and do something that was not only the right thing, but could like, when you left the session, they go, yeah, man, Tim came in and he nailed it, you know? And so that even though it wasn't as creative as a record date, the industrial stuff too was kind of part fun for me in the challenge aspect of it.
Yeah. Was being a session musician kind of the dream from when you had started playing and started getting into being a professional?
Yeah.
That was the more so than like being in a band or a famous rock band or the playing sessions was always the thing.
Yeah. It's funny you asked that question because that is exactly what my thing was when I was a young guy, when I was in high school. And I would buy records. I would always read the back covers and read the liner notes. And I wanted to see who was on this session.
Yeah.
So when I picked up a Loggins and Messina record, or I picked up a Steely Dan record, or, you know, a Carole King record, or whatever, you know,
it's like, who did play on the Loggins and Messina stuff?
Well, that was West Coast usually. So that was probably like you know, Keltner or Russ Kunkel on drums, or okay. probably, you know, Bob Glob or, yeah. Joe Osborne or, mm-hmm. you know, somebody like that, you know, okay. on those record dates. And
I've never looked at those ones actually.
And Chuck Rainey eventually, cause Chuck came out to LA, you know?
Yeah.
But there was some people that you would see these same names over and over again, you know, and sure. you would start to recognize something about their playing. You know what I mean? Like there would be something about them. Even bass players who, like I said, like those days where everybody was playing either a P bass or a jazz bass and going direct, you know, it was kind of hard to like hear the difference between one bass player and the other sonically, but you could tell by what they were playing, you know, yeah. note wise. And sonically too, because everyone's hands sound different, but it was a little bit harder to discern, you know, but that. But right. I really loved, you know, this whole concept of being a session musician, you know?
Yeah.
I thought that was the coolest thing.
Sure.
And so I kind of like, I had this idea in my head, man, I want to be one of those guys, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I had no business thinking this, but I did anyway. I went for it. You know, I mean, I grew up in Brockton, Massachusetts. So I used to like to call the home of the work boot. And it's like nothing. It's a blue collar town, you know? And like, but you know, I started gigging. I started working in Boston. I finally got my way to New York, you know, and I was, like, little by little, I was coming up the ladder, you know.
Mm-hmm. Was that a difficult scene to kind of break into? Is the New York session scene?
Very much so. Yeah. I never really broke the, you know, the barrier. At least I don't think I did. I mean, I did some stuff, but that was another reason why I came to LA too, is because there were just a handful of guys that were doing just about everything in New York.
Yeah.
And they had been there for a long time. And most of them are native New Yorkers. So, I mean, they were kind of in already, you know, just mm-hmm. by nature. Some of them were like their, you know, their dads were in the business. You know what I mean? Like, so there was already kind of an in.
Yeah.
And there wasn't as much work as far as, you know, volume as there was in L.A. And I knew coming to L.A., I found out, man, there's a lot more stuff going on out here. Now I'm talking, of course, this is early 80s, right? But it was, you know, a lot of people were doing records out here. A lot of the films were doing, most of them were being done out here. Most sure. of the TV shows were being done out here.
And TV commercials and all that.
And commercials and stuff. Yeah. And so there were, as you know, there's studios everywhere, especially, yeah, yeah. you know, in Hollywood and the North Hollywood and Burbank.
Yeah.
You know, and Santa Monica, some of them. And so there was a lot of work. So if I thought, well, shoot, man, I can, you know, I can see if I can get in on this, you know. Mm-hmm. I think I had a better chance, you know,
in
to
LA.
Do that than I did in New York.
Yeah.
Because I tried. I was in New York for about 6.5 years. Granted, I did a lot of live stuff, you know, because I was working with Al Di Meola for like 3 years and then with Billy for another 3 years. And then a bunch of stuff around all that. But those were pretty, you know, full-time gigs, most of them, because a lot of them were long tours. And even though I did a record with Al, I did his Splendido Hotel record
mm-hmm.
in the studio, but, and then with Billy, I did a bunch of records, but most of his stuff was just, Billy was a different kind of artist. He would like record a lot of live stuff. And then once in a while we do a studio thing. But I wasn't quite getting all like the, you know, the pop dates and the jingle dates and things like that I wanted to get in New York, you know?
Okay.
It wasn't the frequency wasn't enough, I didn't think.
Yeah.
And when, like I mentioned earlier, when I started coming out to LA and I would be invited on these record dates, you know, I started seeing like not just the way that the musicians were doing these records, but how much work there was. There was a guy named John Pena, who at the time, yeah. I didn't know, but
amazing
John,
bass player.
Yeah. And John was doing all these dates and he was working all the time. And I'm going, what is this guy doing? You know, and I found out these stories that they would tell, you know, like he would go to a party and something. And he was on so many records that like somebody would put on, he'd go like through the record collection and go, oh, I'm on this. And then he'd toss it across the room and go, I'm on this one. And he'd toss it across the room or something like that. I don't know if that's a true story,
yeah, yeah.
but it sounded cool to me.
Absolutely.
So, but I'm like, man, that guy's working on so many records, he can throw them across the room. Well, man, I want to. So coming out to LA, you know, was the right thing to do. And as soon as I got out here, I found out, like I said, there's a little bit more loyalty. And so there was a little bit of, you know, proving ground still.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, like, you know, I would do live stuff, like played like the Big Potato and other clubs. And I started getting a lot of people coming out to see me, and that also helped me get work.
Yeah.
You know, I realized also that there was another level of musicianship out here in LA that I didn't really appreciate until I moved here.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is, you know, in New York, there's always this attitude, like, man, everything's happening here, you know?
Yeah.
And out in the West Coast, man, those guys are cool, but they're not nearly as hip as we are.
Right.
You know? And which is completely false, mm-hmm. you know, but yeah. I, you know, that was the attitude. And when I came out here, there was a different kind level of professionalism, especially when it came into the recording studios that I didn't see in New York. And that ability to come in and just play the most perfect part with the greatest sound and do it over and over again and, like, you know, and make hit records, you know, like that was a thing I saw happening out here that I didn't see to that degree in New York. Of course, it happened in New York and there were people that did that. But in general, it was more of a kind of a slap together kind of a thing. A lot of the dates that I did that didn't really seem to be that way in LA. In LA, there was a lot of time put into the records. I'm talking about making, you know, pop records.
Yeah.
You would go in and they would spend an whole afternoon, like, you know, getting a drum sound.
Right.
Never, they would never do that in New York. No way. It was just way too expensive.
I'm regularly captivated about how geography impacts music. And so do you think that connection right there of things taking a little longer to develop here has to do with just the LA relaxed thing?
Probably.
I mean, everybody's here is just moves a little slower.
Yeah, probably.
Like, man, we'll get to it, you know.
Well,
come over here and hang, get some coffee, we'll talk about it.
You know, think about all these artists that would go, yeah, man, we're going to put the band, we're going to go and do our record, we're going to LA to do our record, you know.
Yeah.
That was a thing, you know.
Right.
We're going to go to LA, I'm going to chill, man. You know, we're going to go to Caribou, we're going to go whatever these, so that's in Colorado, but we're going to like go to one of these like kind of like, you know, studios where,
oh, I remember they would go to like the studios,
yeah, where they go to like, or go to the record plant, and we're going to be parked at the record plant for a month, you know,
right,
or whatever, you know,
yeah.
So, but like I said, as far as the session guys are concerned, you know, I really admired how well people played, how they interpreted music, and so perfectly, especially in the pop vein, you know, like you watch these guitar players like Landau or like Tim Pierce or Dan Huff or Lukather or somebody like that who could just, you know, come up with like the perfect guitar parts and not only like one part, but like have two or three parts in mind, you know,
right.
Have a whole arrangement in their head, you know, how to do this. And, you know, it was different. It was a different, you know, approach to playing. And for bass players, it was, okay, man, I'm going to come up with the coolest, like, you know, part that, you know, totally supports, you know, the song and the singer and the artist, but also has its own kind of coolness factor, you know,
mm-hmm.
and something that might, you know, that might give you a little, get a little attention, you know, drawn to it. I mean,
right.
not that that was the attention, not that you should be doing that so much, but you couldn't help but try to put your own little flavor on something, you know?
Sure. Get a little line that has some movement to it that, you know, someone recognizes.
I mean, there were people also at that time that were doing things like not just Marcus and Anthony, but even like Pino Palladino, who was taking his kind of rock take on Jaco and putting, you know, his fretless thing on these records when he did the Paul Young stuff. And
those were great records.
I mean, he was like, you walked away from that record date going, he did some interesting stuff. Even to this day, you know, you go, wow, man, that was pretty bold what he was doing, you know.
How much creativity would a producer give you on that? Were they looking for like, well, let me hear your part, or like just play through it a bunch of times and kind of work one out?
Yeah. That's a good question. So there were some producers that were known to be like, you know, really open to you trying things, you know?
Yeah.
And of course, that always, it depended on a lot of factors, but, you know, if it was a big record and it was a big record budget and there was time to you know, experiment, then of course those sessions lent themselves more to, you know, you being able to, you know, work out some things and try some different things.
Right.
I mean, there's a producer named Joe Ciccarelli who I worked a lot with. back then, we were doing, for instance, a Tori Amos record. And man, I played so much stuff on that. You know, like there's like a fretless solo in one tune. I'm like, listen to it now. I go, man, I can't believe that they let me do this, you know? Right. But there it is, you know? And so yeah, some producers, they were more open to it. Other ones would be like kind of the more typical, like, no, man, let's just cut this. And you know, I just want to straight ahead and make this a record. No, but a lot of times they'd say, okay, make this a hit.
Yeah.
I want this to sound like a record, they'd say.
Right.
And sometimes you would just do the thing, you know, like a doom, 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 but that's the right thing, you know?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I kind of liked that too. I admired that, the people that could make that work, you know, like doing the thing that's almost predictable, but it just, for some reason, it just...
It's still the best choice.
Still kills it, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, so this, you know, and I admired like John Payne and Steubenhaus, who was my teacher when I went to Berkeley, because I actually met him when I was in high school. I grew up in the Boston area, like I think I mentioned, maybe I didn't. Yeah, I did. And Neil was going to Berkeley, and he was friends with Steve Smith, the drummer. And
okay.
I was complaining to Steve that I wanted, you know, study with someone, because I was self-taught up to that point. I mean, I had taken guitar lessons as a younger person, but I'd never taken a bass lesson with anybody. I was already playing for a couple of years. Anyway, he said, you should study with my friend Neil, man. He's like, you know, he's given lessons. He's a cool guy. And so
he's one of the most recorded bass players.
Yeah, right, eventually, time, yeah. So at this time, he was still a Berkeley student, right?
Okay.
So I called him up. And I said, hey, Neil, you know, I got your name from Steve, and, you know, I'm looking to find a teacher. And he says, yeah, cool, man. Come on up. Bring up your bass, you know, and we'll get together, and I'll listen to you, and we'll see where you're at, and we'll go from there. Said, cool.
Yeah.
So I went, you know, up to have my lesson, my first lesson with Neil. I brought my basses. I had two.
Mm-hmm.
I had a Rickenbacker 4001,
okay,
a black one, a jet glow one with a checkerboard inlay. It was a beautiful bass because I was really into Chris Squire. And then I had a fretless Precision, which was the fretless that they first made, like in 1974 or something. And I just got that, you know.
Recently. Is that the Fender fretless P?
It was like a Fender
with the maple neck.
Yeah, with the it was a rosewood neck.
Okay.
You know, just a plain, you know, no mark, no line, so yeah. Nothing neck.
Remember when they did that with the maple neck? Those basses are so hard to find, but yeah, I thought they looked so cool.
That's hard. Yeah, those are hard to find.
Yeah.
So I brought those two basses. I came in and I played for Neil. And he says, okay, cool. And the first thing he says to me, he says, you know, first of all, you got to get yourself a real bass, pointing to the Rickenbacker, and then looks at the fretless and he goes, and you're not ready for that. So
Shots fired.
I'm like, ouch. You know, you know, he couldn't have been more right. Uh-huh. Because, you know, he said, I should get a jazz bass. That's something you can use in any situation that works in any kind of thing. You know, you can play jazz bass anywhere.
Yeah.
And a Rickenbacker, you know, as you know, it's got a thing, it's got a sound, and like not good for everything.
Sure. So, I'm surprised he suggested a jazz over a P.
Yeah, he did. Because he thought, because of the two pickups, he thought, because you can make versatile. A jazz bass sound like a P bass a little bit, you know.
Sure.
But you can't make a P bass sound like a jazz bass.
That's correct. Yeah.
And that was his favorite thing. You know, that's what he played.
Okay.
So I went and I found an old 63, you know, in those days, it was like $250 or something.
Oh, man.
Yeah, but it had been refinished. It was okay. It was, you know, but I brought it to the next lesson. He goes, this is perfect. And we started going from there.
Cool.
But the reason why I bring up Neil is because, as you said, you know, he eventually became one of the more recorded bass players out here in LA.
Yeah.
And his whole approach to recording and studio etiquette and everything was what I really modeled myself after, because mm-hmm. he was a mentor to me, you know, when I was.
Right.
When I studied with him, and I also studied with him in the first semester I went to Berkeley, and okay. I learned a lot from Neil. I mean, he was an amazing teacher. Unfortunately, he didn't go on teaching. I mean, he didn't teach anymore after that, as far as I know. But so I was very lucky to, you know, be one of his students.
Yeah.
Right. And anyway, he just had a knack for teaching, and he just taught me the coolest stuff and the most applicable stuff. You know, things that you could, you know, use on the gig and use in sessions and stuff.
Sure.
So when I came to LA, you know, I would always call Neil. Neil was like the kind of guy you would call and ask for anything. You needed to know anything, especially if you're new out here. Hey, Neil, I need to get a washer and dryer. I go, oh, yeah, you go to LAtronics, you know, and like.
Neil Steubenhouse, yeah, the original, yeah, Angie's,
yeah,
List?
Yeah, talk to Tony, you know, like, yeah, yeah. Neil knew everybody and everything. So when I started doing dates, he would recommend me for stuff, you know, and which was really cool.
Yeah.
So I started kind of like just paying attention. I even went to a couple sessions that he did. Remember, I went to a couple of TV dates that he was on, and he let me come with him. And I just sat behind him and I watched him do the date, you know, and I watched them. It was with an orchestra. And, you know, when there's like, you know, 30 cues, and each one, yeah, they'd come up and they, you know, they'd look at it, and they, you know, the conductor would count it off and they'd play through it, and then they'd take it. And then move on to the next one. I remember thinking, wow, man, this is like, it's kind of high pressure, you know?
Yeah.
But because there's, you know, 60 other musicians in the room. You, sure, know?
Yeah, you can't be the one that has to,
yeah, you
do can, another
you,
take.
Right.
You have to get it.
You have to be good at that. So I learned, you know, I kind of knew that, but seeing it in action really prepared me for the first time I got called to do a legitimate, okay, date like that. You know?
Okay.
And so that was a good thing for me to kind of know what I'm up against and know how to prepare. I was always a good reader, you know, but reading and reading under pressure are two different things.
Yeah. How did you initially, when you started going out on some of these dates, how were you handling the pressure? Was it a lot, or were you able to keep cool and just trust that you could get through it?
I was pretty confident about my reading and my ability to interpret. Although there were a couple of early sessions where I was sweating bullets.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. I mean, partly, you know, not one time there was somebody playing a joke on me, and another time it was just super hard music.
Okay.
You know? Yeah.
What was the joke? Someone put some unreadable piece of music on the, yeah, stand?
It was, yeah, one of those classic, I remember it was an Alfred Hitchcock Presents TV show. This is, okay, like probably 1985 or something. And I remember Tommy Tedesco was on the date.
Okay.
And Steve Diskin, I think the drummer, I can't remember who else was on it. And what they did, though, they took this like ridiculously hard piece of music. It was like some kind of cello piece. Yeah. And they stamped, you know, like 2 M6 on it, you know, like real two, you know,
yeah,
second Q, 6 Q. And they stuffed it in my folder. So I get to the date, you know, and I'm just sitting there and I'm just kind of thumbing through the music, you know, like you always do. And I, yeah, come across this one piece, and it's like the old, like, you know, fly shit on toilet paper. Like, what, yeah, the heck is this? And like, I take it out and I'm looking at it and I'm like, I mean, it's really hard. It's like an alto clef, you know, there's, yeah, like 7/2 phrases. Like, what the heck? And those guys, they're like, just cracking up.
Yeah.
Behind me. They didn't let me know until the first break. So for the first hour, I kept going looking at that piece.
Every, yeah, time, everybody's trying to count that, through a and couple
it
bars.
It said solo on it. I'm like, wow, man. Yeah. I think it was an Al Silvestri date. It was something like that. One of the big composers too. And the contractor, a woman named Sandy DeCrescent, she was the one you wanted to work for, because she, okay, booked all the dates, you know. So, yeah. Anyway,
what were some of the most, out of all the sessions you've done, what, mm-hmm, were some of the most memorable? For any reason, because it was, you know, maybe because of the artist, or maybe because something, there was some weird left turns that happened on the session, yeah, or.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I have really good fond memories of doing like one of the first movie dates I did, and I was featured on some Fretless things on that, was a movie called Mystic Pizza. I think it was Julia Roberts' first movie.
Okay.
And so, and that was, you know, I got, you know, a chance to play a little bit on it, and it was a good movie, and it was really popular, and, you know, it kind of helped me get other dates. But I remember just being pretty satisfied about the way that came out, you know?
Yeah.
I think also one of the first big record dates I did was for a guy named Robert Tepper, and he recorded a song called No Easy Way Out. I did his whole record, but the one tune from this record that ended up being his hit was on the Rocky IV soundtrack. Oh, okay. And that also was a really fun date because of when I, how I got on it was he was from New York and he'd come out to LA to do the record and they were going through bass players. Like he had already like gone through about five or six players of the LA guys, you know,
yeah.
And he didn't like any of them. And so the producer found out about me, called me and said, hey, you know, we're looking for a bass player for this record date, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so I came in there knowing this guy was from New York. And, you know, I'm from the East Coast and I lived in New York. I came in and I lowered my bass strap a little bit, you know. I took out my pick, you know. I rented an SVT.
Okay.
You know, I just kind of really rocked out, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and he said, that's it, man. That's it.
Yeah,
that's
the guy, man. You sold him on it, yeah.
And so that's how I got on that record date. But it was also a really good record date. It had Myron Grombacher on drums, who was from Pat Benatar's band, and Alan Pascoe on keys, who told me, he said, Tim, don't tell anybody about your jazz gigs, man. They don't want to hear about it. He was talking about doing like rock and pop records. Don't tell them you do that because, you know, they'll think you can't play rock.
Right.
And Dan Hoff on guitar and another guitar player. I can't remember, but it was at Soundcastle Studios. And I remember one day they took so long getting a snare sound and we were playing, I somehow managed to get like a triple scale rate. We're right. Playing basketball out in the back while they're getting drum sounds. And while I'm making all this money. And I thought, man, this is the life.
This is it. I did it.
You know? Yeah. So that was memorable for that, just the kind of the absurdity of it in a way, and also the fact that it was a big hit on that too. And every time that movie's on, you know, it's like it reminds me of that record date.
Yeah, how many times has that happened? Where like, I mean, when syndicated television was not streaming based, and you just come across like an old movie, and you're like, oh yeah, I remember playing on that.
Yeah, it happens every once in a while, you know, like. Just recently that movie, it's an old movie called Midnight Run with Charles Grodin and Robert De Niro. And there's like, there's lots of bass on that one. I can't remember if it was a Danny Elfman thing or something, but you know, it was myself and an upright player and you know, the cues were so cool, you know, and, it just, you know, that's a good one for movie.
I'm looking that up right now. 1988.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
couple years after the Mystic Pizza, that was 86.
86. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, I think the session was in 85, you know.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Who
did the music here? Music by, oh, no, that's...
who wrote the music for Midnight Run?
Not up right now.
I can't remember. It was David Hughes did Mystic Pizza, I remember now.
I'm not that savvy with... right now just showing me... Come Fly With Me, and then obviously like Jimmy Van Heusen, and you know.
Oh yeah, no. Okay. Yeah, I don't know. I can't off the top of my head. I thought it might have been Sylvester. No, it could have been Danny Elfman. I did do one of Danny's first movies, but I can't remember which one it was.
Oh really?
Yeah, yeah. He was just you know delving into movie writing, but you know, record dates wise, I have a good funny story about a Tracy Chapman record. Well, he had me play upright on it. And it was her second record called Crossroads.
Okay.
And so I came into the date and they wanted me to play, you know, like I said, upright. So they set me up in this room.
It is Danny Elfman, by the way. I
found. Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, you were correct.
So in this room, they had me set up the upright. Was also where she, or her, I think it was a Chihuahua. She had a small dog that she took everywhere with her. And like.
Okay.
The dog was in the room, you know, in the little like ISO booth with me.
Yeah.
With my upright, you know, and like with the Neumanns and the everything.
Yeah,
and I'm
like,
I'm saying to the engineer, like, hey, should we maybe have the dog move? Because I kept thinking like, you know, if the dog yaps or moves or anything, it's going to be picked up. You know, those mics are pretty loud.
Sure.
And he goes, no, Tracy, he says, you can't move the dog. So you just, you know, if he makes a noise, you just have to redo the take. I'm like, okay. I get it now.
Yeah.
So.
Dog wins.
So, yeah. So the dog wins. So like a couple of times during some of these tunes, you know, you hear a little bit of a rustling around or something. Well, I tell you, we have to punch dog. You in and like, you know, in the second chorus. another really good record that I really, really like, which, you know, I don't know how popular it is or isn't. It was Stan Ridgway. who was in the band, I think Wall of Voodoo. He did a solo record called Mosquitoes, and it was the coolest record. And I got to play upright on it and fretless and fretted bass, and I got to be creative, you know. Yeah. And I really, like, to this day, I can listen to that record. I really enjoy it, you know.
Okay.
Those are fun sessions.
When in your playing did you pick up upright?
High school.
Okay.
Yeah.
So pretty early on.
So, well, how I started playing bass was because I was playing guitar, and when I was a freshman in high school, I should also say that my dad, who's no longer with us, but he played bass, you know, kind of semi-professionally, we used to call it. He had gigs on the weekend, you know.
Okay.
He had picked up bass later in life. He played other instruments, but he picked up bass when he was in his, like, probably, you know, late 30s or something. And he had all kinds of gigs. He played with this Johnny Cash kind of tribute band, and he played with a jazz group and some other thing, some big band thing, I think. And so he was playing, you know, and he had a bass. And my high school started a jazz band that when I was freshman year. And the guitar chair was already taken by a senior. Like, I was a freshman, like I said. And so my best friend, who was the drummer and the jazz band, said, "Tim, you should audition for the bass chair," because they still haven't found anybody yet. So I asked my dad if I could borrow his bass, and I stayed up all night learning to read F clef.
Yeah.
And I went the next day and I auditioned for it, and I got the gig, you know, I got the chair. Yeah. Nice. So I started playing bass for my high school jazz band, and I started really liking it.
Yeah.
You know, but in order to be in the jazz band, you also, this is at Brockton High School, you also had to be in the concert band and the orchestra and the marching band.
Right. Oh, and the marching band.
Yeah, because they thought that they looked at jazz band, I was like, that's a treat.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
So, and in order to recruit more people to play, you know, some of the instruments that nobody wants to play, they made that requirement. So I ended up playing tuba.
Okay.
You know, and euphonium.
Okay.
And the other bands. And then I played upright or bass violin in the orchestra.
Yeah. Okay.
So they taught me, like, the, you know, the head of the department there was a bass teacher, and he taught me a little bit about, not a bass teacher, he was a tuba player, but he taught me, you know, how they all have to know how to play a little bit of every instrument, right?
Yeah.
So he taught me, you know, just the basics on, you know, fingering and, like, how to hold a bow.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of, like, sawed my way through, you know, these things. But I learned a lot, and I started playing a little bit more, you know, upright in the jazz band here and there. And that's another reason why I bought that Fender fretless when they came out, because I thought I could get that tone from the upright without having to lug the upright around. Because that was the thing I didn't like, you know, was having to carry that thing everywhere. But that's when I started.
A little treacherous on the East Coast.
Yeah. Huh. But I did finally buy an upright. I mean, I bought a K, you know, when it was a pretty good bass. And I started doing gigs here and there, but I didn't really latch onto upright, you know, full bore, because this is like late 70s, you know, when fusion was starting to really be, you know, the thing.
And yeah, everyone, that's an interesting time for acoustic jazz.
Yeah, exactly. So upright was suddenly becoming a little less hip, and, you know, electric bass, and because of people like Stanley Clark, you know, was becoming more hip, you know. And so I didn't really play a lot of upright, you know. I just, you know, there wasn't a lot of call for it.
Sure.
Yeah. So it wasn't until I came, you know, out to LA, really, that I started playing it again. And the reason why I did that is because in order to do, like, movie dates and stuff, you had to be able to double on upright.
Right.
Yeah. So I had to go back to school, you know, basically, and kind of
dust it off,
hone up my chops a little bit. Yeah. So I bought a nice bass, you know, a pretty nice bass, which I still have. And I started becoming more of a doubler, you know. I'm still an electric player, but I play, you know, enough upright to get in trouble.
Yeah. But what's it been like? Like, you came here and got involved with it, with the exception of, like, old Hollywood recording dates. When you moved here and started doing a lot of these sessions, that was kind of a heyday for session players in general. Recording technology at this point is, you know, more advanced. dudes were making, and women, musicians were making a living just being studio players.
Right.
What's it been like to watch this new trend in culture with home recording and everybody's got a studio and no one goes to the studio or hires specific session players, mm-hmm. unless it's an A-list date, you know, yeah. A-list record or something like that?
Well, that's a great question. And I tell you, there's such a long answer to it, but I try to be succinct in just the sense, like, it changed everything, right?
Yeah.
It just changed everything.
Yeah.
You know, for good and for bad. Sure. Obviously, you know, the ability for people to have a multi-track recording at their disposal in their own home was a huge, huge thing, you know, because prior to that, if you didn't have a lot of money, you couldn't put together a home studio with a 24-inch tape machine and a mixing console and everything else that goes with that, including isolation booths and soundproofing and all the cabling and outboard gear. You know, I mean, we're talking about a multi-hundreds of thousands of dollars to put a studio together. So unless you're a multimillionaire, you know, you didn't have a studio.
Right.
So there's that. That's where we're coming from. And so what that enabled for, like you said, where people could make money as studio musicians, which I was one of them, you know, because you couldn't make a record or even a demo or do a jingle or anything unless you booked a studio.
Right.
And you couldn't have your music played unless you booked musicians, you know, or unless you were a band. And so that was our livelihood, and that's the way things went, and it was all great for a long, long time. And then suddenly, you know, home studios popped up. Well, that's cool. That wasn't that big of a hit just yet, but you know, it gave people that were able to the ability to record everything themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it started with people like Stevie Wonder and Todd Rundgren and the like, and Paul McCartney.
Sure.
You know, people that could do that, who could legitimately play a lot of instruments,
right?
Or like Tom Scholz, you know, from Boston. So those people were known for, like, they did everything themselves, you know?
Yeah.
That was cool, but it was still a novelty.
Right.
You know? But over time, you know, that became more and more common, where people save money by recording everything themselves, right? Of course, why not? And then, but the thing that really changed was when we were able to use MIDI instruments and samplers and computers and sequencers and DAWs, you know, which we use now. When that started becoming more and more commonplace, you know, it wasn't unusual then for, like, a TV show, instead of having, you know, a stable of musicians that came in and did the show every week for the composer probably played just about everything. Mm-hmm. A lot of composers play piano or keyboards, so they could play, you know, a Lindrum part, and they could play, you know, a sampled bass part. They could play, you know, a sampled, you know, horn, maybe. I mean, things like guitar and stuff were really hard to do with samples. So guitarists still worked a lot, but bass players and drummers immediately felt the impact of that when sequencers and samplers and MIDI instruments became more and more commonplace.
Yeah.
Less and less work started showing up, especially in things like jingles and TV shows, because it wasn't so critical, you know. It wasn't really happening. It wasn't impacting record dates yet, because you wouldn't go in and make a record with MIDI instruments, right?
Sure.
But you certainly could do a Wrigley gum commercial with one.
Yeah. And you know? Probably the workflow is faster too, because you don't have to wrangle four or five guys.
Well, not necessarily. That was a little argument that people had, because if one person was doing it, it took one person to do all that stuff a lot longer than it took to have five musicians play it at once.
Okay. Right?
Yeah. So there was that aspect of it. But still, you know, bottom line is the bottom line, you know, where they could save money. And, you know, if it's a TV production company and say, hey, man, we could do this commercial for like $5,000 with just using the composer, or we can do it for $15,000 using the studio and musicians.
Yeah.
You know, that was a no-brainer for them.
Sure.
So that's what changed. That's how it impacted everybody. And we suddenly found ourselves in a position where we had to kind of be creative and figure out, well, what else can we do, you know?
At this time, how many dates were union, and what was the union's response to that?
Oh, okay. Well, all the industrial stuff, as I like to call it, that was union.
Yeah.
All of it. I'd say 90% of it, you know. And the union really, you know, discouraged playing what they called dark dates, you know, non-union dates. And I was actually an advocate, you know, I got involved in it because I saw the value of the union, you know, for what kind of work that I was doing.
Yeah.
You know, I was getting paid a reasonable fee. I was also putting money into my own retirement, you know, and I was getting health insurance, you know, and I was getting residuals.
Yeah.
So if you worked on a TV show, it was a union date, and that TV show, like say it was a Friends, which I, you know, I played on some of that stuff, or, you know, I still, you could still see money, you know, you'd see money for years afterwards here and there, you know. If it got sold to some syndicated thing or it got sent to Europe or South America or, you know, Japan.
Yeah, that's a different, you a different get, rage, but yeah, you're still getting money off. Yeah.
Yeah. And which is fair, you know.
Yeah.
Record dates, hardly any were union. Okay. That was always negotiated money. It would be like, hey, you want to do this Stevie Nicks record, you know, she'll pay you $5,000.
Yeah.
You know. It'll take you 4 days, whatever, you know, we think. And if it goes longer, you know what I mean? They would negotiate.
Yeah.
And live work and touring also was non-union. But
but
TV shows, feature films, you know, jingles, that stuff was all of
it. Right. Yeah, I remember when I got here, like the union didn't have too much grasp on too many things. A lot of just the TV stuff. Any sideline stuff, and mainly just movies dates. Because coming from Arizona, even before I left Arizona, a lot of television shows and production companies were going to Arizona to dodge the LA union.
Yeah, yeah, they did.
So like they were using a lot of Phoenix guys for a lot of the television shows to just sidestep the whole situation.
That happened. That always happened here and there over the years. Like you would hear stories about, oh, so and so composer went to Budapest, you know, to record the orchestra for this movie, or they went to Toronto,
right?
Even because you know they could get a good orchestra up there and it would be cheaper.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Because to record an orchestra in LA was an expensive endeavor, obviously, you know. But these are the days of like you know big movie budgets, and the music budget was a pittance compared to the rest of the movie budget. So nobody really complained about it. But, you know, the smaller budget movies, smaller companies, independents, things like that, they were always looking for ways to skirt around paying the union fees.
Right.
You know, I get it at the same time, you know, and all musicians, when the cupboard's getting a little bare, you just got to work, you know?
Yeah.
That's just the way it is.
Right.
You know, what are you going to do? You know?
Right.
Can't starve. You know? Yeah. So, but I, again, you know, I was an advocate for union stuff. I thought it was useful. I thought it was important. And I thought it was definitely, you know, a good thing for most circumstances when there was like corporate money, especially behind a, you know, behind a project, whether it's a record company or not. Record companies, though, would never, they wouldn't. They just wouldn't pay union, you know. Wasn't they didn't have the money, but they wouldn't. But then again, okay, but that's. But the, if you did a record that was that had an orchestra on it, and I produced a lot of these records too, like like a John Tesh, you know, does this, you know, the hits with the something symphony orchestra, and I would, you know, have to book the sessions, and you know that was all union stuff. It had to be because you couldn't get the players you wanted.
Right, outside of the union.
Yeah, they wouldn't do a non-union date. Not an orchestra date.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rhythm sections are a whole other, like a different animal, you know?
Yeah, because you could track this. You could check the rhythm section somewhere else.
Yeah, but just rhythm section players were more apt to like, because they were like the cooler guy. Forgive me, the string players, not cool. But they were like the kind of like, you know, the yo cats, you know,
they used
to call them, you know. They'll come in, yeah. Yeah, we'll pay so and so $1,000 for a day, and he'll come and play. Yeah, you know? Sure,
exactly.
Yeah. So, I don't know if that answers your question or not, but
yeah, no, it's fascinating. I like hearing about all that stuff. Did you ever get into composing?
I did. Yeah. I wrote for a few films, you know, and a few jingles here and there. Probably some of the worst movies ever made, but I wrote the music for them. So, you know.
The first one I was going to ask if you did Hollow Man with Kevin Bacon, only because I hate that movie.
No, but I am in a Kevin Bacon movie, though.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I got Christopher Guest, you know, the guy that did Spinal Tap, and Mike McKeon, those two guys. They made a movie. Well, Christopher Guest, this was his first movie that he, like, produced and directed and budgeted and everything. It was called, called The Big Picture.
Okay, I'm going to look it up right now, actually.
Yeah, and so it's him and Mike McKeon and Terry Hatcher and Kevin Bacon and Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Okay.
So
yeah, definitely an all-star cast. An ensemble cast.
On the recording session for the music, we recorded this song that he and Michael McKeon were singing, which was kind of like a Spinal Tap session, you know. Chris and Michael said, hey, you guys want to be in the movie? You know, saying to us, the guys that were on the date.
Yeah.
That was Mike Miller and Mike Jokum. And, Novi, the violist, and getting somebody. Martin Lund. They said, listen, you know, we'll pay you a little something. It'd be great to have you. So we're actually in the movie and we play a band called the Pez People, and they had us dressed up in Pez dispensers. Yeah. So this is what you get for recording a session for Mike McKeon and Chris Guest. But it was awesome. And we got to play. So I got to be in a couple scenes with Kevin Bacon, you know, so I like to say to my friends, if you're not already within 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, you are now.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
One of my first gigs in LA was opening up for the Bacon Brothers.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. That was, the Canyon Club. Pretty good band. Yeah. They were fun.
Yeah.
Cool. I had blues rock kind of a thing.
At the Canyon Club in Agora or the one in Santa Clarita?
Agora.
Yeah. That's awesome.
It was cool.
Yeah. Kevin's a cool guy. Yeah. You know, I haven't seen him much since then, but he was fun to be with. And so was Christopher Guest, for that matter. That was a long, long time ago, but they were cool.
Yeah.
But I wrote for a movie called Spirits, and I wrote for another one called, something about love. Talking about sex.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Spirits was just Spirits? That's just the name of the film?
Spirits, yeah. And there was another one talking about sex with this. It was one of the Wyans sister. She was in it. Kim Wyans. Yeah. And a couple other movies. One called The Poet. Another one called The Other End of the Line. So, you know, I did a little bit of film writing here and there. And I discovered soon that it's a whole other ball of wax. I mean, trying to get work as a film composer, it's incredibly tight. You know, there's a reason why the people that do it so well because they are geniuses. I mean, it's a really, really, really hard medium, you know, to be successful at. And the hours are insane. Because everyone knows, like, the last thing they do in a movie, like, especially in a big feature film, is the music.
Right.
You know, before they mix it, you know, it's like the music's the last thing. And it's always, and a lot of times, like, they're hoping the music's going to save the picture or a few scenes at least.
Yeah.
Right. You know? So it's super high pressure.
Yeah. How did you feel about the process of it, of writing to picture and all that? Did you enjoy the creativity aspect?
I did.
Of composing?
Know?
Just the everything that goes with it is taxing.
I read the Elmer Bernstein book called, I think it's called On the Track or On the Right Track or something, and it's a book about film composing, and it covers everything, not just the technical aspects about how to, like, you know, how to time out a scene and stuff, you know, but also about, you know, how to write for scene and how to work with directors and it's a really great book for anyone that's interested in film composing. So I went through that, you know, and I, even the first film I wrote for, I did a lot of it myself, but I did hire musicians too, because it was, you know, very low budget.
Yeah.
But I wrote everything out, you know, I wrote the entire score out. I didn't like, I acted as if I was going to present this to, you know, an orchestra. So, because I wanted to kind of train myself to write, you know, properly, you know. I didn't want to like, oh, I can just play this scene, you know, and yeah, that works, you know, and kind of just budget, you know. I timed everything out, And there used to be a program on the Mac called Q-C-U-E that would do the math for you. So once you put in, you know, so you put in like your SMPTE time stuff, you know, you'd say, well, you know, the scene starts here and I have a hit here at this, you know, at 1 hour, you know, 22 seconds and frames. Yeah. And then, you know, it ends here. You know, you could put that in and it would like tell you, okay, well, you can do it at this tempo and the hit would happen at bar 23, beat 4.
Okay.
You know, that kind of thing. And you could write around using those time, you know,
timestamps
references.
Yeah.
Even like it would help you do things like if you needed to like have a retard, you know, or like a slow tempo mm-hmm. changes, you could put that in. It was a cool program. It doesn't exist anymore, this program, but it was very cool. Yeah. Because now, you know, when you use like a program like Digital Performer, you can do that within the DAW, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Tempo, especially with tempo changes and stuff. But
yeah.
Back then it was a separate thing and it would just basically print out like, okay, well, here's your map, tempo map, you know, at whatever tempo you're doing. You could like input the tempo, but you'd have to put in your frames and stuff. And yeah, it was kind of archaic, but it worked.
I mean, it seems like the more archaic version would be having a conductor watch the film in real time and, you know, changing the whole nature of the group in real time.
Yeah, that's right. That's the way they always did it, right?
Yeah.
They would use a thing called a click book, you know, and that's how they timed out their stuff. Because, you know, if you look on the reels when they would be doing when you'd be on a soundstage recording to a film, there would be the flashing dots, you know,
that
would tell the conductor when it's coming in and out, you know,
of
a scene. And that's like, you know, you're definitely doing it, you know, by feel, you know, you get the tempo, right. You get your tempo set up, but you're hopefully, you could still be off by, you know, a few seconds. Right.
And it would, any push and pull, depending on interpretation of the film or where you want the, you know, a crescendo in the music to be a dramatic piece.
Yeah. Especially if you have very specific hits.
Yeah.
You know, so they'd be watching and you could see it like, you know, when you're playing with on these dates and you can see them conducting, all of a sudden you're coming up to a hit and they might even like just kind of like slow it down just for half a bar just to get it, you know?
Yeah.
And then also they would, at the end of it too, they would listen to it and go, yeah, you know, we can move this a little bit and kind of match that. So it was the system and the process behind it was pretty complex and pretty amazing.
Yeah.
That they did this all those years, you know?
Yeah. What have you been working on? What have you been working on lately? Is there any projects in the works or any records you're working on? Or
yeah, I did a couple of records. I did a record for a guy, a guitarist, a really good guitarist named John Philbrick.
Okay.
And he's kind of like a Bonamassa kind of guy. You know, he's really, really good young guy. There's a bunch of people on it. Greg Bissonette played drums in a couple of tracks. And let's see who else is up. I can't think of anybody. I did a record for a band called Secret Sky. They're a British-Canadian kind of world music band, really cool stuff.
Okay.
Tal Bergman was on drums in that one.
Sweet.
Let's see. Well, I just got off the road with Billy, so, you know, with Cobham, so that's where I was for the last couple of months. So.
Right. You're just kind of chilling out and reacclimating.
Yeah, and now, you know, it's holidays, so there's not much going on, which is fine, you know, with me. And I did that gig with Alan Hines and Brad Rebuchen at Baked Potato, which was fun.
Yeah, that was a fun band. It was great to hear everybody play together. I hadn't heard, I don't think I've ever seen Alan live, and then I'd known Brad for a while.
Oh, good,
good to hear him play again.
Brad, I love Brad.
Yeah.
And Chris Wawick is really fun to play with.
He is.
He's so different.
Yeah, I know. You never know where he's going to go with it.
Yeah, and he's like always, so.
He always keeps me on the edge of my seat.
I kept throwing stuff at him, you know?
Yeah.
This because he's cool.
Yeah.
So, you know, like I remember this one tune we played towards the end of the night. I'm thinking, I'm going to put like a Senegalese kind of, you know, groove on this thing, like a little African thing. And he was like, man, right?
Yeah. Which one was that? I don't remember the tune.
Yeah. It was Footprints. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was, man, it was awesome.
Yeah.
But he did like, because everybody plays Footprints, you know, like the same, you know?
Right.
Maybe once in a while, if somebody play it like in a 6/8 feel, but I'm like, man, let's mix it up, you know?
Yeah. No, that was really cool.
Plus, it's the potato, you know?
You can get away with
whatever
you'd like. The potato.
Yeah. So that was fun. Well, that's about it. You know, Christmas. I'm sorry, Thanksgiving coming up and Christmas. I got to get back and do my writing. I was doing a lot of writing, and I during the pandemic and stuff. And I was planned on recording a lot of stuff, and I just made my demos and I never did anything with it. So I got to kind of get back on that.
This is your own personal project?
Yeah, because I've never recorded a record and like or any kind of thing. I've never released anything, and I have a bunch of tunes, and you know, I figured well, may as well do something.
What's kind of the vein? Is it kind of the fusion-y stuff?
It's instrumental, you know. That's a good question. I don't know how to like categorize it outside of it being like it's bass oriented, but like not a lot of bass solos. There's some solos, you know.
Okay.
But it's, you know, it's kind of like, I guess fusion is one way to describe it, but it's not like
Return to Forever
of fusion. Maybe a little bit more like, you know, Weather Report meets.
That's the fusion I like. Yeah. Weather Fusion says Steps Ahead. I really like Steps Ahead.
Yeah. Meets maybe Snarky Puppy.
Okay. You know,
maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, just tunes, like good tunes. I hope. Cool. You know? By the way, what is that bass back there I'm looking at? What is that?
This one?
Is that a Lakeland? No.
That's Dan's new company, D. Laken.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So that's the one him and I co-designed together. That's the signature.
That's nice. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a 5-string fretless. It's a lot of fun.
Ooh, look at that.
Howard Ulyates did the custom pickup for it.
Wow, man, that's gorgeous.
Got a bunch of little tricks on here.
Yeah, like so what's going on with everything there?
Volume, good question.
volume EQ?
Bass. No, treble mid bass.
Right.
This is a passive, so it's active passive. That's a tone control for when it's in passive mode.
Okay.
This is a mid frequency selector.
Yeah.
And then this splits the coil.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's pretty versatile. I checked out these nylon strings because a friend of mine, I was like, hey, you gotta check them out.
You know what's funny, Ryan? I just happen to have this bass here. Can you see this?
Yeah, what is that?
So this was one of my early like Tim Landers, the TL5s that we did with PV.
Okay.
And what's unique about it was like this was like an early active passive switch. Like where bassists didn't really have that. That was one of my ideas back then was like.
Oh, really?
Because on all the active instruments, they were either, you know, active instruments or passive.
Yeah.
But the problem with them was when the battery would go on those days, as soon as the voltage would drop just enough, the bass would just stop working. Right? Yeah.
And you'd get that kind of distorted hum thing?
Well, no, it would just be like
just out.
Soundless, you know? Okay. So you would get stuck on stage, you know, unless you had a backup.
Right. Yeah, you know?
So the first thing I did, I said, listen, man, we got to put an active passive switch in. So this is like a prototype.
Okay.
So this goes way back. This is late 89 maybe.
Yeah, the neck reminds 88? Me of the inlays remind me of the old Yamaha BB series.
Yeah, it's got it says TL5 on it, but so like, you know, we did a lot of stuff. I mean, even the headstock I had them change and like,
okay.
And like, you know, the body shape.
Yeah.
And
my
everything.
First bass was a PV.
Really? Which one did you have? TL40?
The P bass, just the Fury.
Oh, yeah.
But the cheap was like entry level P bass.
So this was the beginning of my signature with them, but it happened to have that active passive.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was good.
And then, man, I wonder what, I don't know if I've ever played a bass from that era, an active bass. It'd be interesting to see, you know, what the preamps were like and how technology has advanced.
I could tell you. Because I designed it. Well, so what happened was, you know, I had worked on a bass with Mike Padula, like the Buzz bass. Like that was me and Mike and Mark Egan.
Yeah.
And then I also worked on a bass with Yamaha, which was the 1600S, I think, which ended up being one of like the BB5000.
Okay.
And then, you know, PV approached me and said, you know, can we make a bass together? I said, yeah. And I said, but I want like complete control over it. So I had this idea, you know, and I wanted a 3-band EQ on board, you know. A little bit, this came from the influence from like the Ken Smith bass that I played back in New York in the early 80s. So everything was going along fine, and we had really good people on it. This guy named Mike Powers, the head engineer over there. And so I got the woods I wanted. You know, they got the body shape exactly right. I mean, everything was working great. When it came time for the onboard preamp, Hartley, the owner of PV, decided he wanted us to use an already, they already had a circuit board they used in one of their mixing consoles. He wanted that to be the, because he didn't want to have to spend more money engineering and tooling up for a new preamp.
Right.
So we kind of had to go with it, and we tried modifying, but the early ones, they were kind of noisy. You know, it worked, but like there wasn't enough control over it. And the EQ points, I didn't like where they were. Frequency points, I didn't like where they were. You know, kind of had to go with it.
Right.
Eventually, after a couple of years, I did get what I wanted.
Were the frequency points pretty stock? Like 500 for the mids, 1K for the treble, like 60 or 80 for the bass? Or those always seem to be the low, somewhere between 60 and 80.
It was like 2K for the treble. I remember that. Yeah. And the mid range was,
probably 250 or 5.
1.2. And then the bass was like 800 or something.
Oh, wow. That's all pretty high.
Or 500.
Yeah. Those are
it wasn't right.
High.
It wasn't right.
There's no bass in any of those frequencies.
The bass was 300.
Okay.
I could be wrong on all of those, but it wasn't what I wanted.
Yeah.
And I also wanted to be able to vary the mid-range frequency.
Yeah.
And they couldn't do that at first, but we did finally get it on the circuit board. You actually had to go and do it internally. But you could. You could do it. That was the first improvement. And then eventually the preamp became more what I wanted. Never ultimately was what I wanted all the way, but and the bass ran for, I think, about 9 years or so. Before they discontinued it and started with the Cirrus.
Okay.
Which is basically my bass.
I remember when that hit. Yeah.
Yeah. So the Cirrus is basically my bass with, the improvements that I wanted. And hardly not having to pay my royalties.
After the Fury, I had the Accelerator, which was an active bass.
I had one of those. Yeah.
Yeah. And man, that was so long ago.
I like that. It had a long scale too. It had a 35 scale.
Yeah, so I originally got the fretless version. I had been playing a few years, and I wanted to try that out. And then I was just, like Steubenhaus said, I wasn't ready for that yet.
Yeah.
So I went back and got the fretted version of the same bass.
Yeah.
And I seem to remember that having a stacked knob where you could select the mid frequency, and then it would boost or cut.
Right.
And I really liked that about that bass, and that kind of spoiled me on parametric mids and sweepable mids still to this day. Like having full control over the mids is something really important to me because of that bass.
That was key. That was what I wanted from the beginning. And interestingly, going full circle, that goes back to my first bass preamp, which I had when I first moved to LA and I wanted to be hip like everybody else. Mm-hmm. I couldn't get the Olympic preamp, but I bought a Furman preamp. And a Furman, what they had, where they were known for their parametric EQ.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I learned to use that, and it's a great way, to be able to, to really mold your sound. So yeah, so what I wanted was that sweepable parametric style mid range EQ at least, on the preamp.
So the potato, what you had the Lakeland 5. Was that an Osborne or a Daryl Jones? It didn't look like a Daryl Jones because Daryl's has a different body shape.
It's the 5560, I think they call it.
Okay.
Which is basically their passive 5-string jazz bass.
Yeah.
With those hand wound pickups though that they make there. What I liked about it mostly was I wanted the 35-inch scale for the B string, and I wanted those hand wound pickups. And
okay,
I
wanted those are the Lakelands? Passive.
Yeah, the Lakelands.
Yeah.
And so I just used like a Sans amp. The bass fly rig, you know, heard of that Tech 21 thing?
No.
It's an analog, like floor strip. It's only about this big.
Okay.
And it's got a little compressor and level thing on it. And it's got, the compressor, by the way, is really super sensitive, but it works.
Yeah.
And then it's got its Sans amp built into it.
Okay.
And it's got two different amp models. So one of them is more like kind of like an SWR thing, and the other one's like an Ampeg, right?
Yeah.
But it has the 3-band EQ on it.
Okay.
And it also has an octave filter thing, which is not really an octave generator, but it like so, but it's kind of cool. So it's all analog. What I liked about it was this is just one little thing that you can kind of put in your gig bag, and it's got a really, really sweet analog chorus.
Yeah, really nice
analog chorus.
Nice.
The thing is killer.
Yeah.
So that's what I was using, and using the EQ on the Sans Amp thing for when I wanted something, you know, a little different. Mm-hmm. But that Lake, I really like that Lakeland. It's so like, you know, there's really not, it's just got a great neck and that extra, you know, scale length for the B string. I always like that. So, and it's other than that, it's like a Fender, you know.
It's pretty, I have a Lakeland over here that's, I like because it's really versatile. It's just kind of a Swiss Army knife.
Yeah.
Bass. Like I can cover a lot of ground on it, and it always will get the job done.
They make good instruments. I mean, I am in between endorsements now because Mike Padula retired.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Actually, a few years ago, before the pandemic. And so I've been trying to play all kinds of stuff. And like, I went back to my Fenders and playing a lot of Fenders. Like on Billy's tour, I was playing just the 4-string jazz bass, like a 62 reissue.
Okay.
And my original, one of my older Padula, that fretless that I had at the Big Potato.
The potato,
yeah, that's an old 85, I think.
Okay.
Buzz bass.
Those had a specific fretless sound. I used to love only the Padula fretlesses. Like
that bass is killer, man.
What were the fretted ones? The Thunder Buzz, or was that the fretless?
He had the Thunderbolt, the Thunder.
Thunderbolt, yeah.
Then the Thunderbolt was obviously the bolt on. The Thunder was the neck through. Then the, I had a Thunderbolt. And I worked on him with the Nuance. That was the last one that I worked on with Mike, which was, you know, a bolt on, you know, kind of nice boutique-y sounding 5-string, you know, with a really great, I don't know what he did to the pickups, but they were kind of soap bar pickups, but they're just really sweet. And it wasn't perfect for everything, but it was really good if you wanted that boutique kind of sound, you know.
Yeah, kind of a boutique-y, hi-fi, Bartolini.
Yeah, because of the bolt-on, it had a little bit more punch. You know,
yeah. To it. I just loved the fretlesses. The fretless, you know, and I was kind of into Mark Egan back then.
How that started was I had a 64 jazz bass that I loved. It was white. It was Olympic white with a matching headstock.
Yeah.
I don't have it anymore. I won't tell you why, because I'm an idiot. But I'll just leave it at that. But back then... I really got into Jaco, and I wanted it defretted, you know.
Yeah.
So I heard that there was a guitar guy, you know, not too far from where I lived, and his name was Mike Padula. He had a company called Padula Orsini, and they made acoustic guitars. Okay. But he also kind of sidelined doing fretwork for other people. So I called him. I said, "Hey, can you do fretwork on a bass?" He said, "Yeah."
Is this back in Boston or New York?
This is back in Boston.
Okay.
So I took it over to him and I said, what I want you to do is I want you to pull the frets on this, you know, put some wood putty in the lines and then cover it with boat epoxy, you know, and then sand it down. He goes, are you kidding? I said, no, this is what I want. This is guy Jaco. This is what he did. Because I asked Jaco what, you know, he told me that. Yeah. He says wood putty and marine epoxy.
Yeah.
Okay. So Mike took the bass and he called me a couple of days later. He says, okay, well, I found something a little better to put in the fret lines. I got this really cool little like white stuff that like, and it looks neater than the wood putty. And he goes, and I also found a better epoxy. It's a bowling alley epoxy. And he goes, and it's nice and clear, and you can see the beautiful grain on that rosewood.
Uh-huh.
I said, great. So he did that. So I picked up the bass, you know, about a week later or so, and I started playing it around town. And everybody was like, man, who did that work? They loved it, including Mark Egan and and then eventually people like Victor Bailey and, you know, everybody would want to play my bass. Everyone would come see me play, not to see me play, but they wanted to sit in and play my bass.
Right.
So
perfect.
So Padula started getting all these orders. Everybody started sending their basses to him, you know, to defret them, you know, and do a fretless job. And eventually, including Mark Egan. So Mark Egan's bass that's on, you know, those the Pat Metheny band stuff is like, that's Mike Padula's work. So So he goes, man, you know, I'm going to start making basses. He was getting so much work. Like he said, if I make a bass, will you play it? I said, yeah. So he made me this all rosewood bass.
Okay.
So when I was playing with Al Di Meola. So I wanted it kind of looking a little bit Olympic style, you know?
Yeah.
So that's where the first Padula body shape came from, was him, his version of an Olympic.
Is that the, you know, the shape with like the kind of big round beehive and then like kind of the skinnier top horn?
It's like the buzz bass thing, you know, like that kind of just rounded, you know, bout and then like, you know, the horns, right?
Right.
And then he moved the bridge up a little bit in the body, because the neck stuck out a little bit, because that's what I thought Olympics did, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I was really long. I was just a big Stanley Clark fan, and this is what I wanted. And he put these gigantic humbuckers on it, these DiMarzios. So that was the very first Padula bass. All rosewood with an ebony fingerboard, gigantic humbuckers, you know, with like kind of looking like an Olympic a little bit.
Yeah.
And it was actually a Padula Orsini. He was still with Sam Orsini, and they were still partners. So that was the very first Padula bass, and I started playing that. And then he said, I'm going to make a fretless version of it. And that was the first buzz bass.
And I still have that. That was with the bowling alley
epoxy? That was with the bowling alley epoxy. Eventually, he moved to another kind of polyurethane thing, you know, but
I remember the feel of them and like whatever he was using for coating, you know, maybe I don't know, early 90s, mid 90s, it was different and it had a different sound and I loved it.
Yeah.
But I never knew what it was or researched.
Super hard surface.
Yeah.
Super hard surface. Like that, the neck finish on that buzz bass I was playing last Monday is the original. Nothing's changed on that bass. Nothing.
Oh, wow.
That bass is like 25. Well, how old is it? 36 years old? 37 years old?
That's amazing.
Yeah. And it's on all those, a lot of the records I talked about, it's that bass.
Yeah.
I played that bass for ages. And that's it looks cool. Like it. You know,
it's kind of beat up. Do you have it insured?
Oh, yeah. Sure, I do.
Yeah, good. Good. I mean,
No.
Yeah. I'm terrible with gear insurance.
I know. So. Anyway, but that's a great bass. He was. I loved Mike Padula. Not only a great luthier, but really super. I don't know if you ever met him, but he was a really incredibly nice guy.
I remember Wabich was going to do this kind of like bass day thing down in Tustin a few years ago.
Yeah.
At this house, he was kind of like doing some booking for and stuff. And he was going to get Mark Egan to come out and kind of do like a little around NAMM time, like this little Padula.
Kind of thing.
But I don't think that did ever end up happening. And I never met Egan or
the Mark's Padula killer. People. He's a great guy. He's from my hometown, from Brockton. Mark.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. He was a trumpet player when he was a young guy in school. And then he went to Miami and started playing more bass. But
yeah.
It's funny that we're both from like the same town. And you know who's also from right next door to us from Foxborough is Tim LaFave.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We're all like South Shore bass players.
Yeah, there's a thing, man.
There's some water going on down there.
Yeah.
To be drinking. But anyway.
Cool.
Yeah. So, okay. But did I give you way too much info or what?
Man, this is great. This has been great.
All right.
Man.
This has been fun, man.
Man, it's an absolute pleasure. Anything, you know, if anything ever you want to talk about or you got some news or you're going on the road or want to talk about or hit me up. Let's do it again.
All right. Sounds good, Ryan.
All right. Thanks a lot,
Tim. All right, man. Good seeing you.
Thanks, man.
All right.
We'll talk soon. Bye.
Bye.
All right. So that was my talk with session bassist Tim Landers. I dug the insight about the session scene and how that influenced bass construction. Like, I love the history of it all, and it was an honor to have Tim on to hear it from him because he was there. He was a cat helping these manufacturers get it together to facilitate the bases that the job required. Yeah, that was great. That was great. Yeah, I really liked I asked Jocko about the epoxy, and then he went back to Padula. That's great. I love that story. All right, folks. That's all I have for this one. I'm gonna sign off. Thanks as always for listening, and I will catch you on the next one in a minute.